Tonight, we're very honored to have John Duran give the roundtable talk, and this roundtable talk then will lead into a discussion. Some of you, I think, are familiar with the way that we operate, but others of you may be new. So usually each year, the COSA committee, that stands for the Committee on Organic and Sustainable Agriculture, chooses a topic. So please come to our business meeting tomorrow, and during that business meeting, we will be discussing what the question for next year will be. And at the end of the talk, I'll give you the room number and the time. So this year, though, we chose to focus on the land grant mission and funding. Essentially, in the last several decades, but particularly in the last few years, funding at the federal and state levels, especially for long-term infrastructure, has been dwindling. And so many of us find ourselves looking for money across a diverse, a diverse set of business and philanthropic sources. And so we have to, though, keep in mind the land grant mission goes back to serving the public. So this doesn't mean that we shouldn't also be operating with business, because business promotes the public in a sense. But there's a reason why we invest federal and state funding into education and research. That's because businesses usually focus on the short-term outcomes they have to be solvent. And educating people takes time and money, and oftentimes people are not as valuable an asset until they're trained. So it's an important investment, then, our federal and state taxes, because essentially what they do is, in turn, they spark new jobs, new opportunities, and new commercial ventures. But also, more importantly, they benefit the public in a way that is valuable, that goes beyond just those aspects. And so today what we want to talk about then is how do we revisit this vision and this mission statement, and how do we communicate to the general public that might not know what a land grant is, or even administrators who don't have an agricultural background, that think the Morrill Act, that was the beginning of the land grant, is nice but old-fashioned. So remember, extension in particular is getting hit hard. And extension is viewed oftentimes as doing outreach only to rural areas and focusing only on commodities. And so this business-as-usual approach is under fire. Now remember, though, in a place like Washington State in the Pullman Research Center, 8% of the wheat in the U.S. is grown. So business-as-usual is good business. However, on the west side, like Seattle, people don't think about the fact that a lot of extension agents are addressing new issues like water quality, and that's very important and pertinent. So that's the types of things that we need to really think about. And so there's nothing dirty about business, but we have to think about how we're spending our federal and state dollars. And I think that might be a reason why people are so opposed to taxes these days. So that was a little longer than I wanted to take. Now I want to focus on John Duran. maybe you, but not us. So John has an illustrious past, and he told me to keep it brief. And many of you are probably familiar with his past, but he was the SSA president. We can't decide exactly how many years of service, 28 with the ARS, and then as a government.
U.S. Army
as well, on top of that. So he's won too many awards, as Ann Kennedy put it, to put on one slide. He's been the head of divisions. Which divisions?
Yeah,
S6?
S3 and Soil Quality Working Group.
Right, S3 and the NCRA 59 Soil Organic Matter Formation and Function Work Group. And part of, is that how the Soil Quality Book initially started, was through that committee?
That was one of the ways, yes.
So, and although he says he didn't single-handedly create the soil quality test kits and soil quality, he was certainly one of the people that was seminal in not just designing the methods, deciding which ones to use, but propagating those methods across, as many people showed, many miles, many countries, and many soil types. So with that introduction, I would like to take leave the floor and give it to John. So thank you.
Thank you, Anne.
Well, it's a privilege to be here. After going through a symposium on the legacy of John Duran, I feel a little strange standing up there. It was kind of interesting feeling. I felt like I had already died, and I was somehow listening to nice, kind comments at my funeral. So, well, I got a ways to go yet, and I've still got my biggest assistant and chief driver, my wife Janet, and I'd like to introduce her, because whatever I've done, she's always been there to support me and keep the home fires burning while I was out running around different places around the world and diving in dumpsters looking for the perfect can to use for measuring soil bulk density. She was a little embarrassed at times to see me leaning down like a homeless person into a dumpster trying to find the perfect can. But by the way, they don't exist. They don't manufacture cans so that they work for downward pressure. They're built to take care of this type of pressure. Anyway, I guess I'll go on. They asked me to talk about the land grant system and public research and education. Well, I've never done very much in that area. I said, well, I'll take a look at it. And it was very interesting to me. I had an opportunity to actually survey and read back in time. Over 150 years ago, Abraham Lincoln's vision to heal a hurting and divided nation, America took on a bold new experiment. With the formation of the USDA, a lot of people maybe wondered, where did the USDA come from? Well, this is where it started. And the Morrill Act of 1862. It's really the first social contract between the government and America and their people. Okay, I can push this one here.
Yeah.
Okay. And it created the People's College, a federally assisted system of higher education. And this has always been big to me. Get it down to the people. I think sometimes we've forgotten. We forget our roots and where we came from and what we're here to do. The Hatch Act of 1887 supported research and education in the public interest and sharing research and discovery efforts with the states. And the final step in this bold experiment came with the formation of the Cooperative Expenses Extension Service with the Smith-Lever Act of 1914, a critical link between the land grant research and experiment stations and farmers. And what I've learned in my time and my career is that you've got to keep these linkages working and established and clearly defined where we can share information back and forth. And the farmer or the producer is our final client, if you will, and should be our major client. Central themes and characteristics of a land grant system: to disseminate information to the public good, at times breaking with tradition. Now that sounds strange, doesn't it? But if we look at the growth of organic agriculture in the last three decades, this is really what it's been. It's been a break with the tradition of chemically intensive agriculture that we saw in the decades before the late 70s and early 80s, and the changing times and conditions that we see with the changing effects of energy use, and the third essential component is research and discovery accessible to public with engagement of stakeholders as our hallmark. I have to read this stuff because I'm not usually dealing in these areas, but when I started looking at some of the writings of Thomas Fretz in his work looking at the land grant system. I was very impressed and moved in many cases. Now let's get down to the real nitty-gritty of credentials here. This is a picture of my father-in-law. He's a mountain man in the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia. Not West Virginia, but very Western Virginia. He taught me more. I went there. I was just a city boy from the Washington, D.C. suburban area. And I went up there one weekend. George, that's his name, was out planting potatoes. He plowed open a furrow in the soil, and we dropped seed potatoes in. He came over and covered up the furrow with the shovel on the plow and the mule. And then I came along, and I was going like this, foot in front of the foot, over the row where the potatoes had been planted. And he said to me, "What are you doing?" I said, I'm creating a firm seed bed, because that's what I'd been taught in general crops and agronomy at the University of Maryland. And what else did I know? I was applying my academic learning in the field for one of the first times. He says, "That won't work here." He knew that these were mountain lands. He knew that these soils were shallow, about 12 to 18 inches deep, developed on marine shale. He didn't know they were developed on marine shale, but he knew that their characteristics. He knew when it rained, the water came down the mountainside, and it would collect in these shallow terraces that they had too few of to farm well, and he knew that soil had to be kept aerated. He said, "That soil has got to breathe." And so for me, that was my first lesson in microbial ecology from a man of the land who had a sixth grade education. And that one story led me to work in my career to develop concepts that put together all of these things about the soil condition, the water content of the soil, the density of the soil, and whatnot, and come up with working with the colleagues and other students and whatnot with a concept of water-filled pore space. I'm showing this to state that we have to keep our science simple and practical, but it also has to be sound. And we can do that if we put our trust in ourselves and we put our trust in the farmer. Let the farmers be the decision makers. The early settlers of the prairies, they struggled to survive in an environment they considered was hostile to them. And I can understand that, moving there from Ithaca, New York, in 1975, with my wife Janet, we arrived in Nebraska. Some people in New York just weren't sure about where this Nebraska was. They knew it was west of the Mississippi. It was a pretty wild country. And I got here and I learned it was very harsh. Far into the fall, we'd have temperatures into the middle of November up in 100 degrees, 104 degrees, and the wind would blow 40 and 50 miles an hour. Or 35 to 45 miles an hour, but enough by the end of the day you'd be sore from leaning in against the wind. And I learned what some of these earlier pioneers had to put up with, and they had to learn to struggle with. We've developed a tremendous agricultural system, industrial chemical complex, to produce food. We've increased our food production 2 to 3 fold over the last 30 generations. But all this has come at a fairly high cost and always subsidized by oil. I usually like to have a microphone on. I just feel kind of strapped in here, but I'll do the best I can. You see over there in the far background of that slide, the oil well pumping away. That's where our agriculture has been totally subsidized by. And all of our infrastructure in this country is set up so that we're totally dependent on fossil fuels for our existence. You can't tell, but there's a fence there that's got some motion detectors on it in the background on the left. Anybody have an idea what that might be?
Military.
What?
Military.
Military, yes. Missile silos. Another characteristic of our agricultural system is the fact that it's been developed through military efforts, wars, and the production of munitions. In fact, this research center right here is an old munitions production site in western Nebraska. When I got to Nebraska in 1975, there was a lot of the Green Revolution scientists that were shocked to discover that agriculture was having an adverse effect on the environment. This particular site here is in Shelton, Nebraska, in central Nebraska along the Platte River. And those farmers were applying about 3 acre feet of water, because water was cheap then. And they were applying about 200 pounds of nitrogen per acre. Or I forget the conversion factor, 220 kilograms per hectare, something like that. But and in their irrigation water, they were applying almost an equal amount because of the nitrate levels in the irrigation water itself. So we began to find out that we were having an adverse effect on our environment. In China, where I had the privilege of visiting in 1988, even these farmers of 40 centuries, if you look at the book by King, they had farmed sustainably for over 40 centuries, but now they lose 18 pounds of farmable soil for each pound of food that they eat. 18 pounds of soil lost for each pound of food produced. And for the first time since the dawn of civilization, we're actually aware that we now have the capabilities of affecting the global environment and global ecosystems with our activities. There was a time we argued about whether we had an impact on climate change or not. I think there's enough evidence now that we certainly are having an effect. I look at four basic threats to sustainability in this world. These are almost like the four horsemen of the apocalypse, if you will. Poverty, the number of people in the world that don't have enough food and enough for living and getting by, almost 800 million people in the world. And war, that is just creeping up over and over and over again. In fact, much of our economies is based on military efforts and war. And what some would call, in the interjection here, a poverty of affluence. I went to a conference in Athens, and the foreign minister from Israel was there. I think Arafat was supposed to be there, and quite a few other heads of state. George Bush Sr. was there at that particular meeting. But I was impressed because the foreign minister from Israel said, you know, we want more and more and more of things we don't really need. We're consumed by materialism. And so what some see in the world, they look at me, us, and say, we have a poverty, and it's called the poverty of affluence, or what some would call affluenza. And the two other horsemen, if you will, the environmental state of the world, water, soils, air, and the state of human health and nutrition and animal health and nutrition. All of these things are coming together at a juncture in time now. The two biggest challenges we have is population growth and the need for an increasing standard of living for most people. A livable standard of living. And our total dependence on fossil fuel and both the monetary and environmental costs that has associated with it. Sustaining Earth and its people takes a balance. And this picture here was drawn by a good friend of mine, George Isley. He was a math teacher in one of our local high schools. And by the way, there's a similar picture in the inside cover of the Journal of Renewable Agriculture and Food Systems, where it's showing the scale of justice, if you will, with the earth in one pan and people, many different sizes, shapes, gender, colors, in the other pan. And the challenge that we have in sustaining Earth and its people is finding out how we can keep a balance between the needs of the earth and the needs of people themselves. This is the title of the journal I've been editing for the past 10 years, of which I'm retiring at the end of this year and passing it on to some very competent hands, Rick Welsh and Lydia Oberholzer. It used to be called the American Journal of Alternative Agriculture. We changed the name of that in 2004. After a lot of discussion, because we felt organic agriculture shouldn't be marginalized as an alternative. And secondly, I've never really been sure that America really has all the answers anymore for the global situation. I heard the other night in the person that was speaking about the Gates Foundation, the fact that they were looking towards China and Brazil as countries to help with helping agricultural development in countries like Africa and other developing countries. I think we have a challenge before us to get back to our basics and work towards a renewable agriculture. And in America, we can take our rightful, I'm not going to say our rightful place. We can play a place that we belong in helping to solve some of the problems in the world. Our greatest challenge that I've always seen as a scientist is finding the ways in which we can translate our science into practice. These are some rules in the real world from a farmer named Tom Franson from Iowa. Water runs downhill. That's a statement about the susceptibility of our soils to being washed away and eroded. Everything is related to everything else. A basic principle of ecology. Ecology, and I think possibly also sociology. As a scientist going through a rather rigorous training in Cornell, I never thought I'd be interested in sociology, but the older I get, the more I find out that maybe that's really the most important thing, is the fact that everything's related to everything else and how we get along as people. There is no free lunch. I've had a lot of so-called free lunches, but there's always a cost somewhere. And nature always bats last. Partnerships. Partnerships with scientists. Partnerships with conservationists. Partnerships with producers. One of the things that I've always enjoyed with working with soil quality and soil test kits was the ability to, for them to be a catalyst that enabled people to get together, to get out there in the field, rather than me coming out as a specialist, taking a bunch of soil samples and then saying, well, I'll have these analyzed in the lab and I'll get back to you. And it, I might get back to them, but it might be 2 or 3 weeks or maybe even months later. We need tools, and farmers need tools, that they can use directly in the field, right at the time when they have their questions. Partnerships with farmers. And this afternoon, I think some of the speakers today did a much more eloquent job of talking about some of these relationships. Achieving global sustainability. What can you do? What can I do? I'm only one person. But we all realize, or we should realize, that change must come from ourselves, from within. And we must be the change that we want to see in the world. It'll get a little touchy-feely here. As I received the NASA's International Prize for the Environment, it came with $250,000 stipend. Wow. That's all I can say. I told my wife that I had received this award, and I said we had to go to Athens, Greece to accept it. She says, can we afford that? Well, anyway, we got to Greece. We got to Athens. And after that ceremony for that award, we were traveling around, and this picture was taken on the island of Crete. I don't know what church that is up there on the hilltop in that olive orchard. Mount Eta is in the background, the legendary birthplace of the mortal Zeus. I'm not even sure who the mortal Zeus was, but I do know that we have our ideas. And I thought, as I stood on that hilltop and looked out over the horizon and felt the wind waft over my face, and after having just been through these big rigmaroles in Athens, Greece, with all kinds of incredibly wealthy people, and realizing that not much has changed in the eons of time, in the thousands of years of civilization has existed. But there were certain things that remained constant. And really, there's only two things that we have to do. We have to love one another. I told you this is going to get touchy-feely. And if you have trouble with that word, say respect one another. Okay? And if that's too much for you, put up with one another. Because that's what it's all about. And we need to work together. Work with the people you don't like as well as the people you like. And we need to care for the earth. If we can do these two things, we'll be successful in our personal lives, in our family lives, and in our lives together. Went to a workshop in the mountains of Colorado. It was in the Garden of the Gods. They have some sort of retreat center that's in a castle up there. And we were meeting there, and oh, I didn't get this change. You know, drives me crazy with Microsoft. I have to talk to Bill Gates. This business with updating these versions of PowerPoint. I'm used to 2003, and now I've got 2007. And when I import slides in, boom, I lose all my formatting, and then I can't find where the heck to find it to redo it. So, oh yes, I know all about it. Actually, I was there. I was there once, but I went over to the dark side. Anyway, Pius Peter Bloom was a workshop lecturer, and he says, choose your enemies carefully, because you often end up working with them and discover that they are often the key to your future. I know that sounds strange, but let me tell you something. In my experience, I found I heard a story, and I don't know if I'm going to get these details right, but anyway, someone came up to Abraham Lincoln and said, "Mr. President, I don't understand why you treat your enemies so well." And the president thought a minute, and he says, "Well, if I treat them like friends, they're no longer enemies, are they?" So anyway, there's a lot of good substance to that. And I found myself, some of the people I've liked the least have often turned out to be my best friends and companions and associates. This is the end of the beginning. We did a video called, you can Google it, "Sustaining Earth and Its People." And it was done at Charlotte, North Carolina. That was in October of 2001. Not far long after September 11th. And the significance of that was I was trying to get vision statements from different leaders. Floyd Horn, who was the administrator of ARS, I called him on the morning at 8:15 of September 11th to get his vision statement. An hour and a half later, I was no longer able to access him because he was held up in a bunker in the mountains of West Virginia with all critical personnel staff for their protection after the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center. But he did finally get me his vision statement. And this is his vision. "A world in which our scientific and technological breakthroughs are utilized to benefit the health, safety, security, and community of all people." And he recognized that this was the biggest problem we have. And then other people. Timothy Reeves, the Director General of CEMET, is that right, in Mexico? His vision was a world where the gulf between the haves and the have-nots are closed up through more equitable global sharing of knowledge and resources. Tom Sims, at the time he was soon to be Soil Science Society of America president, a new vision for agriculture, one that's going to balance our need to increase ag productivity, protect natural ecosystems, and improve the quality of our air, soils, and water. There's an interesting picture. We took this in 1984 in Australia. Wow. The Premier of Australia passed the Brigalow Land Clearing Act of 1982, I think it was, where they take bulldozers and just clear the acacia trees, which were uniquely suited for that country as nitrogen-fixing trees that would move their leaves with the sun to maximize photosynthesis and minimize transpiration losses of water. And in this area, I'm sorry, I can't help but laugh at this. You know, God must have a lot of good humor, because when he looks down and sees what's going on here, they've cleared the acacia trees from this land here. It's really steep. They had to have a D9 Caterpillar with a winch on it to pull the tillage implements up and down slope to till that land. Then they planted the steeply sloping land to pineapple. You can even see the soil slumping halfway up there. And you'll notice that they have their cattle grazing on the grass in the nearly level lowlands down below that they're burning off to increase the productivity. So I don't know what's wrong with this picture. Oh, I was called in on a sabbatical to work there to try to solve and find out why the productivity of their soils, they cleared all the acacia trees off them, was declining in time. Another thing we're needing to work with, and organic systems do a good job of helping us over winter stress periods and stress times, and give us resiliency to change. This is a vision of David Irwin from Oregon. Systems, sustainable agriculture and food systems with sufficient resilience and diversity to adapt to uncertain natural and social stresses. In this case, a tornado. This is taken in Nebraska. You see the tornado over there into Iowa. It had just gone through here. It was in August, before September 11th, in Jackson, Nebraska. But the systems we develop have to be able to have the resiliency to take care of the climatic and weather stress. Charlotte Haynes, the co-founder or co-owner of Haynes Hosiery, making small farms more profitable so farmers will retain their land rather than selling it for development. This picture was taken near Lincoln, Nebraska. It's a small CSA co-op. It says Equinox, so they're now called Common Good. Richard Rominger, former Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, his vision where family farmers are paid for their conservation efforts, not just to produce a crop, but to produce a sustainable soil environment and a sustainable agriculture. In 1990, Warsaw, Poland. I had the privilege of traveling to Poland to work on a special foreign currency fund with some of the Polish cooperators in Puławy. We got there, they wanted to take me to the Ministry of Agriculture in Poland. Now this is 1990, just after the wall got torn down. And you'll see there, my interpreter had to tell me what those banners says, but it says, protests that they had taken over the Ministry of Agriculture, the farmers had. Protests of the peasants. No freedom without justice. You know, we don't have a cookbook for democracy. And I think what they were looking at was the trappings of capitalistic democracy and were wanting the same things. They had gross inequities in the country. Prices of milk varied from 3 to 10-fold across the country. So they were wanting something new. We're back to the same challenge again. Charting a course towards sustainability by translating science into practice. Sing a new song to the earth. Been working on a ballad for about 10 years now. I think it's 10 years. My wife's shaking her head. Yeah, it's been at least 10 years. Sing a new song to the earth. I'm not going to make a comment about that. That's planting high technology in Brazil, where they're harvesting with one line of combines. They're following directly with another via combines with planting. I don't know if they're Roundup ready crops or not. Hard to tell. Sing a new song to the earth. Restoring hope to the people. This is some work in Africa that a good friend of mine, Nanga Mahdi, is doing. And this is in Chad, but he's working in Central African Republic. Giving hope to people. I think there's some opportunities that we have in this world where those of us that are better off can help others with different kinds of support and help, similar to the Millennium Villages project that's going on in sub-Saharan Africa at the present time. And I think it's interesting to me to see people like Bill and Melinda Gates are willing to take a good part of their money and use it to develop things to help those who are struggling with food and survival. We need to remember, we're the old, there's also the young. We're the past and we're the future. And our lives are a foundation for a new world to come. This picture was taken in Australia in the rainforest. You'll note there's an old tree stump and there's a new tree that's growing right on top of that old stump. Oh, I could make all kinds of biblical comparisons here, but let's not worry about that. Let's think about what each of us has to contribute to ourselves and to others. Many of us may be that young tree, or we may be like some of us, or the old tree stump that's been cut off. But even if it's been cut off, it served a purpose. It served a function, and in this case, it's provided the basis and the foundation for that continuing life and organization and structure that's important to moving forth. Sing a new song to the earth. Nitrogen fertilizer plant in Puławy, Poland. I forget, 6 million pounds of anhydrous or fertilizer a day they produce there. You can even see the dark brown nitrogen oxide clouds in the horizon there. And in China, a tremendous loss of soil. Again, restoring hope to the people. These are some pictures here about biointensive agriculture. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that, but it's a double dig system, non-inversion tillage, a hand system that's available to, it's being currently used in about 130 countries around the world to provide people with adequate food and even some economic gain and advantage for using it. John Jevons from Ecology Action in Willits is kind of the founder of that technique. May we each day love one another. My good friend Kostas Bouliouris from the island of Crete, we were traveling along, and you know, I had true confession time. I'm kind of an A-type personality, and you just don't get over that. So I guess I'm a recovering A-type. It's kind of like alcohol. But Kostas, we pulled up to this little fruit stand, and I said to Kostas, I said, ask the lady, can I take her picture? He says, wait a minute, calm down. Just let's get to know her first. So we got meeting with her, and she offers some of her fruit, and we sat there and talked a little bit. And I was amazed, this little two-way highway there, I heard a car coming. All of a sudden, the lady, I don't think I understood what she said, but it sounded like it was, excuse me. And she puts her fruit down, and she scurries across the road. Because she had a fruit stand on the other side of the road as well. And she was serving both of them. So, but the point is here, we're back to this may we love each other business. Don't be so intent on your agenda that you miss out on meeting the people around you and finding out what's unique about them and their particular ability to share with you what they have to give. And working with our kids and our children and education projects, this is all part of the big picture of how we can share the future with the younger generation. been my privilege to work with people all over the world, different languages, different colors, and it's just been a privilege I've had. I feel like I'm standing on sacred ground in the midst of many of these people. And again, constantly restoring hope to the people. A workshop biointensive. I'm not being disrespectful, but I don't know why I thought these nuns here from Malawi, I called them the flying nuns. I don't know. I just had that image of, that flying nun. Was it Sally Field? Anyway, they were tickled to death because I gave them a few little things like soil pH paper for measuring soil pH and things of that nature. And at this particular workshop, it made me feel real good and realize that maybe we do have some things that we can share with people that's at a technological level that they can work with themselves. Sing a new song to the earth, for creation begins every single day. That's the hands of a biointensive farmer in Pennsylvania. I think it's Austrian winter pea. He's holding, you see the great nodulation on those roots for nitrogen fixation. I think we've seen this one before, haven't we? And we've seen this one, sorry. I didn't quite get them all edited correctly last night, but there are others that view the same images. John Eichert, his challenges and opportunities in American agriculture. Again, the golden rule follow, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Others, Norman Borlaug, his dream, a world free of hunger. And even Bill Gates. Isn't this interesting? I never thought I'd hear this from Bill Gates. Technology itself will not solve the problem. Poor farmers are not a problem, but a solution to hunger in the world. If you haven't had a chance, you really ought to visit the CSA News, Volume 54. I think that's... I can't remember what issue that is, but it's worth looking at. It's the Green Revolution 2, a sustainably intensified agriculture. And one of the summaries from this article was, in the future next green generation must be guided by the needs of smallholder farmers, be adapted to local circumstances, and be economically, little misspelling there, sorry about that, any economist out there, but economically and environmentally feasible. We heard over in one of the other talks just a little while ago, we were talking a lot about soil quality. And one person was observant enough to say, why do you keep talking about soil quality? So what? And I've had farmers in Australia tell me, you scientists, quit giving me your soil quality indicators. I need tools for management. Give me something I can use. And the lady in that session was talking about economics. We need to be talking about economics as well. And so as we look at the place of organic agriculture in the future, we need to look at the ability of organic agriculture to help us deliver these products of environmental quality, of economic stability, and environmental maintenance or improvement. Post-millennium agriculture will be a returning to basics. I don't know if you'd call this a returning to basics, but it's a way we can get back to get rid of our addiction to fossil fuels and fossil fuel use. I saw a movie, Janet and I saw a movie the other night called Bag It. It's about plastics. I never knew. And I'm not going to make any ads here, but you'll never know what kind of effects we have with the plastics we use, including the bottles we drink milk out of and whatnot. I'm not going to go there any further. Thank you for your attention, and I think we're pretty much on time. I'll just go up and throw a few things up for consideration, because we're going to have some time for discussion at the tables this evening. I'd ask you to look at these four questions, and as you talk at your tables about discussion topics, don't necessarily answer these four questions, but just consider them as a focus for your discussions. And I'll leave these up at the end of this talk, so they'll be on the screen, so you don't have to write them down. They'll be up there on the screen. First question, do our concepts apply to and meet the needs of all people, even the poor? And again, the Gates quotation, poor farmers are not a problem but a solution to hunger in the world. Two, do our efforts serve the public good and foster private sector growth for the common good? Do our personal agricultural systems ensure long-term resilience and performance under future limiting conditions? And this was one of the major questions that came up in the preliminary talks with COSA about this meeting. You know, dealing with limiting conditions, social stresses and upheavals, climatic change and extreme and weather events, and resource limitations of water, energy, soils, and other non-renewables. And for us scientists who like to run around in the field, Ray, and chase butterflies or whatnot, can we give practical examples of present systems, integrated systems that work for society? We're always going to need further research. But what do we have now that we can put on the ground right now and say, here's an example of something that's working somewhere? And as I don't want to reveal anything here, so Rick and Lydia, I hope I apologize, but we're looking at the possibility of a new section in the Journal of Renewable Agriculture and Food Systems. It's called In the Field, and it's basically, it's modeled after some things like Ray Weil has had the privilege of creating little slide series travelogues, or diaries, if you will, for some of the work he's done in Ethiopia with the Millennium Villages Project. And Ray, if I get this wrong, correct me, please. And we just think that would be a great venue for doing something in the Journal of Renewable Agriculture and Food Systems to create, maybe through a commentary where somebody is describing an issue or some outreach project that they're doing in a different country, and then to supplement it with an online accessible version of a slideshow that's annotated. And it would be reviewed to make sure you don't have any crackpots sending stuff in. But I think that points a way to the future. Hey, no, Ray, I love your stuff. It's always solid foundation and basis. And there's the questions. And it's 5 minutes early. Thank you very much for your attention. What? Why don't you give them the directions?
So John is going to float around between the tables, and for people who haven't participated in the discussion part, usually we refuel, we get food and more drinks. And then we sit down at the tables, and we designate one person to take notes and another person to facilitate. So if you have a lot of people who talk at the table, your role is to make sure that everybody gets a chance to have a say. And if you are the scribe, even though other people will be taking notes at the table, please try to summarize as best you can what the individuals at your table are saying and what conclusions you're going to draw from the comments. And then we'd like to leave time at the end for each table to designate one person to come up to the podium and summarize everything that you said, and so that has to be brief. So if we've got, I'm not sure exactly how many tables we have, but if we've got 20 minutes at the end, so you really have just a brief period of time to discuss and transcribe, then that would just be a few minutes per table. It would be less than five. So with that in mind, go ahead, whoever is raising their hand. Did you guys have a comment at the table next to the bar? I saw a hand go up. Were you just making a gesture? Okay. Hi. Okay. So there are some. Go ahead, Alex. So, right. So we have about an hour left, I believe. Half an hour. Okay, so 15 for discussion and writing, and then 15 for the summaries. And some people have already agreed to facilitate or to be the scribe at your table. So those individuals, please designate who you are. And if there is if there are a few tables that don't have somebody who's agreed to do that, please choose someone that you know or have worked with in the past that will be good about turning in the notes. Because that is a struggle every year. We put this into CSA News, and we always have this flurry back and forth for a week. Where's the notes from table one? So anyway, I don't want to take up the time with instructions. I want you guys to have a chance to discuss the questions. But I would say let's try to keep it to about a two-minute time slot for each table. And so I think there's four questions here, and we were hoping to boil them down into one, but I'm going to go ahead and give you guys license, and just remember you have a time limit. So if you wanted to pick one question, that would be fine, or if you want to come up with a synthesis question, that would be good too. So I'm making you do a little bit of the work. Go ahead, John.
You can use these questions kind of as a focus for what you want to talk about. If you feel strongly about a certain issue that you think is important for organic agriculture to consider, use that issue and for discussion, and then focus it with these four questions here as to how you're going to resolve that issue. Does that make sense? Anyway, good luck. I'll be rotating around.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so amazingly enough, time is up. What we're going to do is start with one of the back tables. Kathleen is going to summarize what the conclusions of her table are, and then if you would just volunteer as you're ready. There's a few groups that didn't sit down until the end, and they may be quietly talking amongst themselves. That's okay. And the majority of you, though, hopefully have come to some conclusions and can listen to the other tables' interests and solutions to some of these problems.
All right. First of all, I'd like to say thank you, John Duran. John, we're calling you, for all your inspiration. And these great questions. But of course, John, we have to return your question with a question. When you say, give examples of integrated systems that work, what does the word work mean? You can answer it now, or you can send me an email as far as your response. But that was something that someone at our table brought up right away, is what do we mean by work? An example at our table that was given, though, was this really beautiful example from Ontario. That's Canada for all you Americans here, or U.S. people. There's an example of an urban garden there that's empowering people to grow their own food versus relying on food banks, because as it turns out, the food banks, they're good. They're good for emergency supplies, but primarily they're supplying high starch, high carb, and canned processed foods. So to get fresh fruits and vegetables, empowering people through these urban gardens is a way to go. And one way they've been getting free supplies to run this urban garden is through hitting up seed companies that have been supplying seeds for their efforts for the urban garden. So it's all about, as John said, building connections and getting people to work together. So that was just one quick example we had from our neighbors to the far north. Thank you. Oh. All right, Liz, you're next. All right, skip you. Who else is summarizing? Stefan, you ready? Pat. Oh, Pat, come on up. And Pat's going to write up everything, so send your summaries to Pat.
Well, let's see. We got to about the fifth word and the first point, and that's about as far as our group got. So we actually thought we had a little bit more time to work with. In terms of, and seriously, that's about as far as we got. The group talked a little bit about concepts and do they apply and do they meet the needs of all people. I guess initially the group kind of zeroed in on the initial green revolution. There was some question as to whether the Green Revolution in the end was targeting the group that it initially was aimed after, because it required the poor to really become dependent on external inputs. At least that was the feeling of some in the group. So with the push for the new Green Revolution, it was suggested that what's evolving is kind of a top-down approach again, and maybe that isn't quite the way that this new revolution should be approached. Is that right, group? I don't care. Okay. Okay. then Stefan brought up, what are some of the bottlenecks? And we kind of zeroed in on we had a couple students in our group, which was really nice, in terms of what are some of the bottlenecks. One of the students did bring up the fact that they felt experiential learning was very important and certainly could be used to supplement and maybe even be used in tandem with more of the traditional type of formal in-class type learning experience, and she said her experience with the CSA at Colorado State has been a great experience for her and for some of the people that she's interacted with. And then Yvonne Lawley up in Canada felt that at least the farmers that she's working in Canada, she feels a lot of the farmers in Canada, the conventional farmers, I'm guessing, Yvonne, right, recognize that the system that they're working with, the conventional system they're working with is not really sustainable long-term environmentally or otherwise. But they're challenged right now. They don't see a good conduit to move to a sustainable system. So maybe that's a challenge for everybody. And that's about as far as we got. I apologize, but we were just getting started. So, did the group want to add anything else? Did I miss anything? Okay.
Well, we had the privilege of having John at our table for a little while, so we thank him for visiting as he floated around the room. But we went off the rails a little bit, or went sideways a little bit from the questions. And we talked about things like public education being very important in all of this. Getting non-stakeholders and educating. If we're going to rally support for efforts in sustainable and organic agriculture, it's important to get the folks that don't know anything about it to know something about it and continue those efforts. We had an example at our table of someone, a Master of Science graduate, who went and stayed in a homeless shelter. And from that experience developed and I'll have to get with the person that said this and make sure I have it right in the notes. From that, he developed a grant application and ended up getting funded for over $150,000 for educating high school kids in Nebraska on sustainability issues in agriculture. And I thought that was kind of fascinating that he leveraged this experience, and he's going to leverage that for the betterment of his whole community there in Nebraska. One of our people asked, where will the funding come from? Conservation and research funding for organic and sustainable agriculture, it's big time on the chopping block with this farm bill as it has been with past farm bills. And others at the table brought up, all of agricultural research is always, someone described it as low-hanging fruit. Well, it is. It's much harder to have a discussion of how many destroyers or whatever we need versus, well, do we really need someone to study sustainable ways of maintaining reduced populations of cabbage maggot or something like that, right? So it's easier just, no one cares about that, it's just cabbage, we can eat broccoli instead. Oh, wait, they get it too. Oh, wait, well, no, well then we'll eat collard greens. No, they get it too. Anyway, but research we thought was pretty important. In general, the policy issues were important. We think the policy issues and getting that discussed is important. We need to connect more with our urban agricultural systems our urban audiences, rather, about ag and get them educated about this. That was discussed. Someone asked a provocative question. Is extension the correct venue to deliver the information that we want delivered or that needs to be delivered to folks about what we do and what we can do? The question was, are they responsive enough? I don't know. That's an interesting question. I think they could be. I think some of them are. That's not in the notes here. That's my editorializing. But it's interesting. But I think that's a topic for discussion, is how do we enhance the value of extension to this? Let's see. The urban ag thing came up again. Someone mentioned the systems where they're doing the sheet composting on I know a lady who's doing it in Mississippi. She's doing it on a tennis court. She's got a foot of organic matter on a tennis court. She's going to grow vegetables on an old tennis court. Well, what happens when it rains? We get 54 inches of rain where her farm is. Where's that nitrogen going to go when it leaches out of the bottom of that tennis court or out of the bottom of that organic matter and runs off? Managing these new urban agricultural systems and understanding them from a holistic point of view and a sustainable point of view is very critical. Closing that system, making sure we understand the whole loop and the cycle, and managing that cycle correctly. Policy issues again came up. Someone mentioned FFA, and I'm getting near the end here. Someone mentioned FFA and increasing the sustainability training within the FFA programs to educate our future farmers. And that is it from our little table in the corner. And I want to thank my group. It was a very interesting discussion.
Should be able to do this pretty quickly because our table sort of coalesced in the last moment, and I think we only started a discussion. So they asked me to come up because I was the only person that had a chance to say anything in the discussion. So this isn't exactly the groupthink from our table, but we started at the bottom with the last question. We thought if we can think of some systems that work and are integrated, maybe they should do all the things in the first three questions. And the system that came to my mind that I've had been most impressed with in the real world that actually works and I think is sustainable and actually makes a living for farmers is and this is done in most of the climatic regions of this country, and it's the intensive grazing-based dairy systems that maybe 1 or 2% of dairy farmers in this country are practicing. But all the studies show, including a little bit of work that I've done, that they improve soil quality, they improve environmental quality, they improve the life quality of the farmer, they improve, and this is one of the places where we have good, hard biochemical data, they improve the milk, and they make money for the farmer, even if they're not getting an organic subsidy or premium. So you wonder, why isn't everybody doing that? I think it's such a sea change of thinking about it that it will take some time, and of course there's very little to sell. The second thing we thought about was sort of the mantra that John was talking about is the farmer is our ultimate customer, our ultimate person that we should be working for, really isn't going to work for us too well in a country that only has about someplace between 1 and 2% of the population that consider themselves farmers. So maybe that should be the eater is the ultimate user. I mean, it seems to work better in a place like, say, Malawi, where 80 or 90% of the people in the country are farmers than in a country like ours. So those are kind of the two thoughts that we had. Was there anything I missed? Thanks.